Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm sitting here looking at a movie poster pinned to the wall of the studio. It's for the Luther movie. Rebel Genius Liberator. I'm always wary of these kind of things. Not only is the subject matter near and dear to my heart, but, you know, Hollywood doesn't have the best track record for reproducing history, especially when it comes to history that's so closely tied to eternal things, things that really matter, like the gospel of Jesus Christ, how someone is justified by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone. That was Luther's message. After this came clear to him through the Word of God, that was the driving force behind his life and his career as what would later be called a reformer. How does the new Luther movie portray Luther? Does it get the gospel out? Does it get the gospel straight? I'm sure you're asking yourself that question as well. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest for a few minutes here at the beginning of this third hour. We're going to be talking about Luther the movie. He's interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House. Paul, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks, Todd, and greetings from Concordia Publishing House.
You have seen the Luther movie. Tell us about it.
Yes, I was able to screen it a couple months ago in Chicago, and I went, quite frankly, very skeptical, very leery, a little bit afraid of what was going to happen. I had high hopes for it. I had received a number of assurances from the producer that I wouldn't be disappointed, and I'm pleased to say that I was not disappointed. I was thrilled. In fact, I can't wait to see it again. I'm going to be able to see it again Friday morning with a number of employees of Concordia Publishing House, and I am just really impressed by what they were able to accomplish in a movie intended to reach a basically secular audience, people who know very little about Martin Luther, and I think they do a very fine job.
What is it in particular about this Luther movie that impresses you, with which you were pleased?
Well, if I had to pick only one thing, it would be this, that they did not, I think their advertising campaign, I know why they're doing what they're doing, but it's a little bit misleading, you know, Rebel Genius Liberator. That's kind of the snazzy way of saying it, or the sexy way of saying it. But what this movie does not do, which I'm so glad it does not do, is make Luther to be out a, you know, spokesman for the common man, or the great champion of free speech, or individual rights, or social movements in the West. It keeps the focus very clearly on Martin Luther's struggle to find peace with God, and where he finally found that, in Christ alone.
Does it get the gospel straight, and does it get the gospel out?
Yes. I wrote a review of the movie, and one thing I said in that review was, you know, would I have liked to have heard Luther saying more and more explicitly about the gospel? Absolutely. But what is said is stunning. I mean, I just sat there in shock to see on this giant screen an honest-to-goodness, full, high-quality, Hollywood-type production movie with a big-name actor, Joseph Fiennes, to see him standing there holding a copy of the Bible saying, Christ is among us through his word and sacraments, and also to hear his mentor, while he was a Roman Catholic monk, Staupitz, telling him to cling to Christ and actually put in his hand a crucifix. That was very, very powerful. And there's no way anybody can leave this movie not knowing this is clearly a man whose passion was for Christ and the Word of God.
One of the things, just as a film buff,
yeah,
that concerns me about movies that attempt to take off a big bite like this of what many would probably consider one of the more obscure chapters in history, is whether or not you can tell the story. And, you know, exactly what can you cover when you've got a career that spans the better part of 50 years of the reformer?
Well, this is not a relaxing movie. You will not be lulled into feelings of peace and tranquility by watching this movie. It picks you up right from the get-go when the giant lightning bolt strikes the ground next to Luther and he promises to become a monk, and takes you on a really wild ride until the very last scene where he hears that the German princes have stood up for the evangelical faith. And there's a lot to pack into this movie, which comes in under just shy of 2 hours. They're covering the years 1505 all the way to 1530, so it's a 25-year period. That was my concern. Is it going to be too much for the viewer to understand? Now, I've been told that others who were in focus groups for this movie, from older people to young college kids, all enjoyed the movie, and one of the young women who saw it left and said, I can't wait to see it again. It's very exciting. It's very well done. I'm amazed at the level of historical accuracy they are able to achieve.
So it is historically accurate?
Yes, it is. In details, probably nobody but Luther nerds like me are going to recognize. For instance, when they go to the electors, his protector in Wittenberg, John Frederick, when they go to his castle, you actually see these giant, huge paintings that we're all familiar with, you know, on the printed page, but these were commissioned from Lucas Cranach, the famous Reformation painter, to decorate these giant castle walls, so they're very large paintings. I noticed that, and they wouldn't have had to have shown that. Now, what's interesting is where they come up with absolute fictionalized portions. For instance, there's a scene early in the movie which is debatable. Luther deals with the suicide of a relatively young teenager. Totally fictionalized as far as I know, but it's done to show us something about Luther's frustration with the Roman Catholic system of indulgences. They use a very effective device. They create a fictitious poor woman and her daughter, crippled daughter, and it shows her, and you get to understand indulgences through her experiences of buying one. It's extremely effective. There's no better way of explaining the impact of indulgences on lay people in those days than as is done in this movie. It is extremely powerful.
Several months ago, PBS aired a documentary on Luther that was an attempt to kind of walk through Luther's life
right
up to the same point from Life of Reformer up through, let's see, probably The Diet of Worms.
Right, right.
How does this movie, the Luther movie, compare with that documentary?
Oh, well, for one thing, I have to be very honest and say I couldn't stand that PBS special. I thought it was awful. So I'm not unbiased here. This is so much better. First of all, it is a movie. It's not a documentary. You actually see people. You don't see vague images. And I just thought the PBS thing is quite boring compared to this movie. This movie gets you right into the action, and it does declare the gospel. The PBS special did not have one clear gospel proclamation in the whole thing. It came dangerously close a few times, but it never happened.
And what about the depiction of Luther as a man? My biggest concern probably going in is that he is a giant of history, and the temptation of the movie maker would be to depict him as a romanticized, bigger-than-life figure.
No, in fact, my concern is just, based on watching the movie, my concern is that some people might leave the movie thinking, man, Luther was nuts, because they show Luther in the agonies of his spiritual torment as a monk. I mean, and it's quite disturbing, but from everything I've read about Luther's spiritual torment, it's probably quite accurate as well. No, this shows Luther the very human man, but it also shows him as a man greatly determined, greatly consumed by a passion for the truth. That really comes out in this movie. Joseph Fiennes is the actor who plays Luther. I think what many people will be surprised by, and they shouldn't be misled by this, is that until, frankly, Luther was married, he was a very gaunt, thin man, and I think this movie does a good job of showing us the younger Luther, which we often associate Luther with kind of the chubby, portly, older Luther, but this is definitely a younger Luther, as is appropriate.
Why should our listeners see the Luther movie?
Well, first of all, if they're a Lutheran listener, they're going to want to see it. They're just the curiosity factor alone. But regardless of whether you're Lutheran or non-Lutheran or even Christian or non-Christian, Martin Luther, first of all, is a giant in history, a fascinating man whose personal journey to try to discover spiritual peace led to this revolution in world history and Western civilization. That's one thing. If you're a Christian, you're just going to want to see what was really going on at this time in the Roman Catholic Church. The movie does a beautiful job of depicting, frankly, the horrible abuses at the time, but it doesn't do so at the expense of honestly saying within the Roman Catholic Church there were people who were concerned, there were people who were bothered by these things. So they do present sympathetic Roman Catholic characters as well. And then finally, for Lutherans, it's just an absolute thrill to see, frankly, my personal hero, Martin Luther, depicted in such a strong, dynamic, vibrant way.
Pastor Paul McCain, thank you very much for giving us a brief review and preview of the Luther movie.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Pastor Paul McCain is interim president and CEO of Concordia Publishing House. Folks, I want to invite you to a private screening of the Luther movie this coming Saturday, 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday the 27th of September, at the DePere 14 Cinema at 12701 Manchester Road. I will be there leading a discussion before the film and after the film. It's $10 per person. The cost includes your admission to the film and a soda and some popcorn. You can reserve a ticket by calling tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-844-0524. 1-800-844-0524. Have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready when you call. The private screening will be Saturday, September the 27th at 10 a.m. at the DePere 14 Cinema at 270 and Manchester Road. I'll be there. I hope to see you there as well. 1-800-844-0524. Now, we're going to be staying on the movie theme, but we're going to be changing the subject of the movie. How has war been depicted by Hollywood, and how has that depiction of war changed over time? I remember the war movies of my father and my grandfather's generation. I remember the war movies of my generation. I didn't like watching them. They depicted war in a way that made it very difficult to find anything redeeming in war. And then came the era of, I guess you could call it the Saving Private Ryan era, where war took on a different cast in cinema. What's different between the original war movies and those of today and those that came in between? We're going to talk about that for the next few minutes with Brian Gadawa. He's a screenwriter in Southern California. He's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment, and he's also written a recent column for Script magazine called War Movies, The New Trend in Themes. Brian, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Oh, it's always great to be here.
Can you, as a screenwriter, can you tell me when you're writing or working on a war movie, is that different from telling any other kind of story?
No, it really isn't. It's just that you have a specific arena, and, you know, it sort of creates a genre of itself, and so there are going to be things that are in your movie because of the context of war that are in most movies, things you have to deal with. And, yeah, so I kind of just see it as sort of a genre. It's a genre that has its own formula of elements that need to be there, things that you need, that people expect to see, you know, that kind of a thing.
Now, let's start with the first war movies. War has always captivated storytelling. I mean, many of the classics of the Western civilization are really stories about wars and men at war. When films started to take up the subject, how did it treat the subject of war and tell these stories within the context of war?
Well, you know, I think in some ways if you watch cinema, you see cycles, you know, that often reflect social trends, and particularly they reflect social views of war at the time. In other words, you know, usually films sell, you know, they're trying to make money, so the films that get made are the movies that appeal to audiences many times, not always, but. And so, you know, days gone by, the 40s and the 50s, you know, you had these movies, you know, the John Wayne era, you know, Back to Bataan, Fighting Seabees, Green Berets, these kinds of things. And in some ways, I write in an article that, you know, in some ways, these were like, you know, World War II propaganda more than just storytelling. You know, they would tend to depict the villains or the antagonists, you know, the Japanese or the Germans as cardboard villains, and the Americans were grand heroes fighting for the big noble cause. And, of course, there's truth to this, and particularly with World War II, there's truth to this. But it does reflect a generation of, I think, some naivete in not recognizing some of the real horrors of war, as well as some of the, you know, unjust things that America may have done. You know, in other words, we're not a perfect country, and even if we might be on the right side in a particular conflict, that doesn't mean everything we do is correct. But in that particular era, it tended to focus on that side of things. And then you get the new era because of Vietnam, of course. Vietnam is where, you know, America loses its innocence, and so as well in the movies does it, particularly about war. And so, you know, my era, you know, from the 70s up until the 90s, you know, most all war movies were about Vietnam because most people from the 60s had that mindset, and a lot of the filmmakers came out of that, the rebellious culture, and their view was America's always wrong. Whereas it used to be America right or wrong, now it's America's always wrong. America's never right, always wrong. And so they always focused on Vietnam because of the political nature of it, and so movies became very politically oriented, and the goal was to show all military men, or, you know, most, at least military leaders, as being warmongers, you know, insane people. You know, you remember the Robert Duvall character in Apocalypse Now, where he's walking down the beach wanting them to surf in the middle of a fight. You know, this kind of insanity. So really it was from war is glory to war is insanity. Not just that war is hell, but war is actually insane, and the men who do it are insane. And so you have this whole era of Vietnam movies that it was just really, like you said, there's no redeeming element to it. America's always wrong.
So in other words, you got kind of John Wayne standing, you know, at the brow of the hill.
Yeah.
There's no moral ambiguity in this depiction. Then you've got Robert Duvall's character walking the beaches there with the napalm being dropped, saying, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." Obviously, a person who considers war to be glory, kind of a caricature of the John Wayne person being recast as the kook.
And interestingly, that particular script, Apocalypse Now, was written by John Milius, who actually was a war buff. And the irony of it was he wrote that script as a sort of a paean to the glories of war. And Coppola, Coppola took it, and in his hands, he crafted it to really show the insanity behind it. So there's a real irony in that particular film, you know. But yeah, so that's basically what we've had for the last, you know, 20 plus years, you know. And then, like you mentioned, along came Saving Private Ryan, and this was, you know, one of the first big World War II movies in many, many years. And now you have a film that's really sort of a strange hybrid. And I didn't really mention this in the article. I probably should have, but, you know, on the surface, it's really more about the glories of a just war, you know, and the nature of, you know, here we are, you know, fighting a just war, and saving men are worth it. But ironically, it also, if you look closely, it brings back the individualist element, because all these men are Americans who really don't want to be there, and they're just trying to get Private Ryan so that they can get back home. That's all they really care about. They're not really as much devoted to the cause as I think the men were in that time. In other words, there's a sort of a stripe of non-ingenuity there, non-genuineness, you know. And so, but nonetheless, you look at the bookends of that movie and you really see the essence of that story is freedom is worth dying for, and in particularly in that war, it's right to kill evil people who deserve to die. And that was something that had been missing for a long time in movies because of Vietnam. So that kind of brought back a whole new trend of movies that I write about that deals more, it focuses more on the existential experience of the individual soldier rather than the big patriotic cause and rather than the dirty politics. And so it's sort of interesting that this focus on the individual and his experience in war movies like Black Hawk Down, you see Four Feathers, you see We Were Soldiers Once and Young, K-19, you know, I write down all these quotes from the movie where it really, all the guys are saying, it's really not about a cause, it's about the man next to you and fighting for him. But, you know, in a way, that's just as imbalanced as all of them, because that's a negation of the cause, the justness of some wars, you know? And it's interesting that corresponds to the postmodern shift of the focus on the individual and his personal individual ultimacy is what matters. You know, it's not, you know, things like, you know, the country and the nation are not important. It's the individual that counts, you know.
So we've got John Wayne, where the cause was everything.
Yeah.
The Vietnam era movies, Apocalypse Now being kind of your prime example, where the cause was everything, but it was unjust. It was wrong. To the postmodern treatment of war, for as good as the depiction was in Saving Private Ryan, where the cause is irrelevant.
Exactly. And, you know, if you watch the We Were Soldiers movie, which, by the way, I thought was a, you know, brilliant film, and Randall Wallace wrote and directed, and he has a lot of respect for the Warriors. But even he, in that movie, said that he tried. Interestingly, it's about the first battle of Vietnam, which all, you know, for the last 20-plus years, all movies about Vietnam were how wrong America was. And yet here he made a movie where it really wasn't about America being wrong at all. It was about respect for the individual soldier. And he says as much in the DVD on an interview. You know, he says, look, I wanted to get away from the politics and say, look, both sides have human beings that are dying here. And, you know, we need to respect the men who fought for us, even if we don't accept the politics. And that I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know what I'm saying? There is, you know. And that's what I think. There's a lot of that national sentiment right now with the Iraq war. In fact, if you notice, traditionally conservatives tend to be for war and, you know, liberals tend to be against it. And yet in the Iraq war, you know, even the liberals were very, very careful to say, well, you know, even if we disagree with the war, we really support our soldiers. That's something that they didn't do in the Gulf War, and they got in trouble for that. So there's a real recognition of, even if we don't agree with the cause, we still respect the soldier. I think that that's well needed. But it also can create an imbalance.
Now, you have written a war movie, To End All Wars. Obviously, with these things in mind, where did you try to strike, if not a balance, and the accurate picture of the soldier in this context, telling the story that there's obviously politics and greater causes at work with which not everyone on the battlefield is going to agree or disagree? How do you do it?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And it should be released sometime this year, hopefully. But anyway, what it's about is about some Allied prisoners of war underneath the Japanese in Burma during World War II. Basically, if you saw The Bridge on the River Kwai, this takes place in that same area, the same situation, only our story takes place in what happened outside of that bridge, you know. So anyway, these Allied prisoners of war are suffering under the Japanese, and it's sort of an East-Meets-West story where we sort of compare the Western individualism of the Allies against the collectivist spirit of the East with the Japanese. And really, in that story, we see that the individualism is a very in the Allies is a very selfish, destructive viewpoint, you know, survival of the fittest. It's the evolutionary ethic, see? And yet, on the Eastern side, we show that the collectivist spirit produces, you know, the belief that the individual has no value, therefore it results in a lot of violence and, you know, beatings and torture of men because they don't value the individual. And so in that story, we bring out both extremes, both sides, both viewpoints, and show that they're both inadequate to really deal with, you know, what is it all about? How do we really find, you know, it's like, it's the conflict of kingdoms, the kingdom of the East and the kingdom of the West. But there's another kingdom that's much higher that can unite the individual and the whole in a way that none of man's worlds can. And what that is, of course, is the kingdom of God, because the Bible comes in the camp. They start teaching the ethics of Jesus, and it starts changing the Allied soldiers from self-love to loving their neighbor, and they start to help each other. And then by the end of the story, they're faced with what it means to love their enemy, a very, very powerful, true story, by the way. And it was my attempt to sort of address that issue of how do you balance the one against the many, the collective cause versus the individual.
Brian Goodow is our guest. He'll be with us for a few minutes after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Paul addresses his Colossian letter to those who are in Christ. What does it mean to be in Christ? Does it have anything to do with baptism? What are the benefits of being in Christ? Explore the theology of the Book of Colossians with our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. To order the book, go online, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $39.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September.
gorgeous opals produced in months?
Answers with Ken Hamp, one of the editors of Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, I was taught that precious stones like opal formed millions of years ago. I understand that this idea is now being challenged.
Well, I do have some startling information. You see, evolutionists claim that opals have been created over millions of years. In fact, something like 30 million years ago. Now, these opals are certainly beautiful stones. In fact, the finest opals have become more expensive than other gems. And I'm thrilled to say that my homeland of Australia is responsible for practically all of the world's supply and my wife's opal ring. In our Creation magazine, we shared a story of a committed Christian in Australia who's discovered the secret to grow opals in glass jars, and they're stored in his wooden shed. And you know what? The process to make opals only takes a matter of weeks. Even the most experienced opal miners can't tell the difference between opals formed in the ground and the ones this man has grown in his laboratory. He's shown conclusively that it doesn't take millions of years to form opals. So what can we say about these beautiful gems? Real science agrees with Genesis. The Earth is only thousands, not millions of years old.
Did dinosaurs really die out 65 million years ago, as evolution teaches? Actually, the Bible says something very different. Ken Hamm shows how in his fascinating booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? Your free copy can be obtained by going to our website, answersradio.com.
It's 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, mostly clear tonight, low of about 50. For Tuesday, sunny and a high near 77. Right now in St. Louis, it's partly cloudy and 76. More on war movies follows this break. Then an update on the euthanasia case in Florida with Wesley Smith. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 before Lindbergh, the left lane is blocked. Traffic is backed up to McKnight. Eastbound 44 at 270, there's an accident there and traffic is backed up. Northbound 270 at Dorset Road, slow traffic. Then in the right lanes, exiting on 270. Westbound 70 between 70 and Cypress, there's heavy traffic. Taking a look at the bridges, eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic. And northbound 55 between Old MacArthur Bridge and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane.
Next time on the Bible study, let's talk about the clergy. Let's talk about ordination and installation, and let's find out if it connects in any way to Aaron and his sons as described in Leviticus chapters 8 through 10. We'll talk about it with Pastor John Lukomsky next time on The Bible Study. Our program is heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about war movies. Brian Gadawa, screenwriter in Southern California, is our guest. He's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. How do you think, Brian, Hollywood is going to depict the war of today, this conflict that is not just with Iraq or Afghanistan, but this different kind of war on terrorism?
Wow, yeah, that's a good question, because I think Hollywood still has been reticent, you know, to deal with terrorism in movies in light of 9/11. But interestingly, because terrorism is focused on a politically correct group, in other words, Islam, the religion of Islam, they have always been fearful of dealing with it. For instance, the movie Some of All Fears, based on a great Tom Clancy novel about a Muslim terrorist who bomb a football stadium with a nuke. And that was written years ago. And they made the movie long before 9/11. And they changed the terrorists from Muslims to neo-Nazis. Of course, that's the easy bad guy. And not only was it stupid in principle and didn't work, but it really just showed the fact that whether either they're afraid, you know, and maybe rightfully so, if they depict these guys in movies, they're afraid they might get a fatwa against them, or it's just political correctness that you don't depict Muslims as being that way. And I think that that's the problem that we're under, is that they're going to really have a hard time doing it because they're very politically correct. It's okay to make them, like, make terrorists Christians, you know, maybe if they can paint them as Christians, then it's okay to make them terrorists. But Muslims, you don't touch that. That's not nice. That's not politically correct. So I don't know how they're going to really overcome that.
Terrorism is also a less defined enemy. It's the kind of enemy that you in film, you can't necessarily depict the big battle scene like the storming of the Normandy beach and Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, but you know, in some ways, it's more interesting because of the, let's put it this way, it's more interesting from a story level because in a way, terrorism is individual acts, which lends itself better to a movie. It's more personal. Which is I think works better for a movie. Sometimes battle movies, you know, some people are bored with battles and stuff, and understandably so. Those of us who are war buffs maybe don't. But so in some ways it's more akin to movie material because it's more along the lines of the kind of things we do in movies anyway, you know, conspiracies, all that kind of stuff. However, oh, by the way, I wanted to put one caveat there, too. I just remembered there was also a movie, though, that was made before 9/11, and it was called The Siege, and it was about Muslim terrorists, but they got a lot of flack for that, and I thought it was a good movie in principle because of what it dealt with, where it really did deal with the notion of Muslim terrorists actually bringing havoc down in New York City.
Two final questions here, Brian. First of all, if someone puts pen to paper to write a screenplay, a war movie telling a story in the midst of war, what do they need to say? Beyond just telling the story, what needs to be said about war in order for it to be not the romance of the 1940s and 50s, not the pessimism of the 60s and 70s, and not the kind of pure individualism of the most modern war movies?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I would say that, you know, the goal is you need to seek to have a balance between a righteous cause, if it is righteous, or showing that it's an unrighteous cause, if it's unrighteous. So you need to deal with the cause. You need to deal with individuals and the value of the individual despite the cause. So you basically have to have a balance of characters. How I would do it is, and which is what I did in my movie, To End All Wars, I try to have a balance of characters by showing different characters in the same situation who respond differently. So you have all the various viewpoints involved in there. So in other words, you know, you don't want to have all the military leaders be insane men or warmongers like Thin Red Line and, you know, Apocalypse Now. But yet you also don't want to show that men are only in it for themselves and only care about themselves individually, you know, which is like the Four Feathers and such. And so you just have to try to strike a balance of that and show that, you know, I would say that maybe a good way of doing it, I think Saving Private Ryan did a good job of where they really did show men who, or no, best one yet, recently great movie with Bruce Willis called...
Tears of the Sun?
Tears of the Sun. Terrible name. Great movie because it shows a man who's a mercenary. He goes in to save people behind the lines in one of these countries. He's just a mercenary, just in it for money. He is a metaphor for America, but through trying to get these people out to get his money, he sees the atrocities going on in the country. It turns his heart, and it becomes a mission of mercy and compassion. It's just very powerful. It balances. It shows a man going from a mercenary to compassion, and I think that was a brilliant example of the kind of movie that deals with individual interest as well as the greater cause in a good balance.
Finally, if you had to choose one from the John Wayne era up till yours, and I'm going to ask you to accept your movie, what would be your favorite war movie? The best one, if you had to see, only keep one in your DVD collection.
I know this sounds pretentious, but it honestly is To End All Wars.
All right.
Yeah, it's my favorite movie. It's one of my favorite movies anyway, and so yeah, that would be it. That would be it.
I guess that's, you know, when you finally get around to it, if you want it done right, you got to do it yourself.
But second would be Braveheart. Braveheart, because Braveheart did seek to balance a notion of freedom, the individual, but also the greater good of freedom and how freedom is a higher value even than security, which in today's world, and even many Americans, they don't realize that we trade off security to get freedom, and you trade freedoms to get security. And everyone, as they keep giving away their freedom in order to be more secure, but from the government, they're getting control, more and more controlled by the government, and that's many of the problems that war is caused by, is the tyrannical oppression of governmental control.
One last question, Brian. The movie Luther is opening in 300 theaters this coming weekend in 55 major urban areas across the country. Do you have any plans to see it? What are your expectations about a cinematic depiction of this man in history?
Oh, I'm so excited. I'm jealous. It was one of my stories I wanted to do. I'm jealous that they did it, that I wasn't able to be a part of it. I'm excited to see it. Can't wait. But, you know, you never know. I do know that there were some believers who were involved with it. So, I'm hoping that it's not, I don't think it's going to be as derogatory. But again, you know, I think there, it's more easy to make a movie like this because who's the bad guy? The Roman Catholic Church. And that is one of the perennial bad guys that it's okay to knock in movies, you know. And so as long as the guy is one man, you know, Luther is one man against the world. Well, what's the world in this case? It's the Roman Catholic Church. So, hey, that's okay, you know. So they don't mind doing that. But, you know, if it's able to come out with a truthful story, that's fine with me. And I do have a friend who was involved with it a little bit. And I'm very hopeful about it, but we'll have to see.
Brian Gadawa, thank you for your time, and thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Brian Gadawa is a screenwriter in Southern California, author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. He's written a recent column for Script Magazine called War Movies, The New Trends in Themes. Brian has a website. Perhaps you'd like to visit it. It's Gadawa.com. That's GODAWA.com, Gadawa.com. The remainder of the program today will be spent with Wesley Smith, our good friend and regular guest. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. We're going to get an update on this euthanasia case in Florida involving Terry Schiavo. Wesley, welcome back.
Hello, Todd.
What's going on with Terry Schiavo and her case in the courts?
Well, it's pretty ugly. Judge Greer of the Sixth Circuit Circuit Court in Florida has ordered Michael Schiavo, the husband of Terry Schiavo, to take away her food and water beginning at 2 p.m. on October 15th. Jeb Bush, who many have urged to step in and intervene in this case formally, not with just a letter, which he's done previously, which really doesn't accomplish anything, but to formally intervene, has not acted, and I don't know that he will. Pat Anderson, the attorney for Bob Schindler and his family, who are Terry's father and family, has filed a federal case claiming that this dehydration of Terry, when you haven't even given her the opportunity to receive therapy to see whether she can eat by mouth, which many have testified she could be able to do, assuming proper rehabilitation, that this violates her civil rights and is a discrimination against a cognitively disabled woman. I mean, consider this. You have some doctors who say she can't get better and that she can't ever learn to eat by mouth. You have other doctors and therapists who say she can. Seems to me there's one way to find out, and that's to try. But this judge refuses to try, perhaps because he is more afraid that it would succeed than it would fail, because if it succeeded, it would be classic and clear evidence that he had ordered a woman to be dehydrated against Florida law.
Okay, so let's walk a bit through a brief history of how we came to this point. And then I'd like you to explain the ins and outs of Anderson, the attorney's, Pat Anderson's line of thinking here, the legal pursuit in trying to basically stay this woman's unlawful execution. How did we get to this point, Wesley?
Well, we got to this point starting in the 1980s. The bioethics movement started arguing that tube-supplied food and water should not be considered humane care, which cannot be denied. For example, keeping a patient warm is humane care. If a patient wanted to be frozen to death in front of an open window during a blizzard in Minnesota, they wouldn't be permitted to do that. Turning is humane care. Keeping a patient clean is humane care, and food and water should be humane care. But if it's provided through a tube, the bioethics movement argued, and many in medicine, then it should be considered medical treatment. And the reason for this redefinition was because medical treatment can be refused. Therefore, if tube feeding and hydration kept disabled patients alive when that is not what was wanted, you would be able to refuse tube-supplied food and water ethically as a matter of withholding or withdrawing unwanted medical treatment. The big case that went that opened the door to that was the Nancy Cruzan case back in 1990, in which the United States Supreme Court actually protected Nancy Cruzan by saying that Missouri was right to have a statute that said you need clear and convincing evidence before you withhold life-sustaining treatment of that sort. But what it said by implication was that food and water supplied through a tube was indeed medical treatment that could be withheld. Very quickly after that, and in all 50 states, we have now gone to, almost as a matter of routine, dehydrating conscious and unconscious, cognitively disabled people to death based on quality of life determinations. I'm not talking about withholding food and water when there's a medical reason to do that. For example, when people are actively dying, and you're a pastor, I'm sure you've seen this, sometimes they stop eating. And there's a reason for that, because their body is shutting down and they can no longer assimilate food and water. In that circumstance, continuing to provide food and water is not medically appropriate, and I don't object to withholding it at that time. But we're withholding it from people like Terry, not because it's medically inappropriate, but based on our basically invidious discrimination judgments, in my view, of the quality of the patient's life. The only time these things are stopped, sometimes, and sometimes they're not stopped, but the only chance is when, as in this case, you have a division within a family. And this is, the third big case in the last several years, in which you had spouses wishing to dehydrate their husbands or wives, fighting in court parents who are trying to keep their children alive. The first big one was Michael Martin, in which Michael Martin, according to doctors, had basically indicated he wanted to live through answering questions and nodding his head, and a judge still ordered him dehydrated to death, as did a court of appeal. But the Supreme Court of Michigan said you need clear and convincing evidence, and you don't have it in this case, and his life was spared. The next case was Robert Wendland, which we've discussed on this case, which was remarkably similar to Michael Martin, in which the patient, Robert Wendland, could drive a wheelchair down a hospital corridor, and you still had a hospital ethics committee saying he should be dehydrated to death. The trial judge said no, but the Court of Appeal said yes, stating there was no presumption for continued existence in the law of California, which as a Californian turned my hair white.
You have no presumption of continued existence.
That's what the Court of Appeals said. Luckily, the California Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we're not going to go down that road, and said you need clear and convincing evidence, which again they said did not occur in this case. However, in the Wendland case, because these trial judges allow the spouses who want their former loved ones or their loved ones, however you want to describe it, to die, they allow them to continue to be in charge of their medical treatment. And there are other ways other than withholding food and water to see that somebody doesn't make it. And in Robert Wendland's case, the wife refused to permit Robert to be taken out of his room for rehab by his mother, who was doing it, and indeed out of his room, and he eventually got pneumonia, and my understanding is that eventually he was refused antibiotics, and he died of pneumonia before the Supreme Court of California rendered its decision. And now we have the Schiavo case, which is the same kind of thing going on, and indeed, even though Michael Schiavo, the husband, could make money off his wife's death, and wishes to remarry. He's engaged. He has one child by his fiancée. She's pregnant with a second child, and the only thing keeping him from marrying his fiancée is that his wife is still alive. The judge still allows him to be the one in control of Terry Schiavo's medical decisions. It's unbelievable.
After speaking with you, in fact, before speaking with you the last time on this, I emailed Governor Jeb Bush in Florida. You had mentioned in your previous article on this, I think in National Review Online, that there was something that could have been done in that case. I got kind of a form letter back saying, look, we wrote a letter.
Yeah, they wrote a letter, and that and two bits will buy you a cup of coffee. You know, writing a letter, it's a nice gesture. It was a political gesture to his base, his political base. But a judge is free to take just a letter, just like the judge would be free to take my letter or your letter and say, listen, this is not part of the case. I'm not going to pay any attention to this, which is exactly what Judge Greer did. For Jeb Bush to be able to save Terry's life, he would have to direct the state, the Attorney General or the Department of Public Social Services, to intervene legally in the case and say, listen, I'm going to bring some order out of this chaos here. I mean, this is ludicrous. This woman is having a husband who wants to remarry in charge of her medical condition. A judge has said she's unconscious when anybody can look at the videos of that are available of Terry on terrisfight.org, T-E-R-R-I-S-fight.org, that she's clearly not, that a court of appeals has ordered that the dehydration commence. I mean, this is ludicrous. I'm going to step in. I wouldn't let a child who is in foster care be dehydrated to death. I'm not going to allow this young woman who's in the same position as a child be dehydrated to death without at least having a formal oversight by the Department of Public Social Services. But he's refused to do that so far. And or he has not said why he can't do it. He's just been silent.
Now, let's, in the time left to us, see if we can outline the case being put forth by the St. Petersburg attorney, Pat Anderson, attorney
for the... Who is a hero, heroine.
And what is she arguing? Walk us through the legal aspects of her argument in order to try and stay this unlawful execution.
What she has argued is that dehydrating someone to death is not one act that is clamping the feeding tube. It is actually two acts. First is clamping the feeding tube, which is withdrawing medical treatment. That's what the law says. But the second one is refusing to give the cognitively disabled person food and water by mouth. Remember what I said at the top of this interview, what the difference between humane care, which cannot be withdrawn if it's and medical treatment. If Terry could eat by mouth, which several doctors and therapists have said they believe she could be retrained to do, then you can't deny her food and water any more than you could deny a child food and water or you or I food and water in that sense, because it's not medical treatment. And so what the attempt in the trial court was to say to the judge, listen, as a matter of treating Terry as a full human person and protecting her right to life, which is a fundamental right in the Constitution, you have to give her an opportunity to receive the therapy that many say she will enable her to eat by mouth. Otherwise, you're just killing her. The judge, again, refused this, and so now that becomes the basis of a federal case in which she says that there is collusion, as I haven't read the full complaint, but I have talked to her about this, that there is collusion and state action, which is the judge's order at Michael's request, to deprive Terry Schiavo of her fundamental due process rights and her right to life under the Constitution. And so today a complaint was filed in federal court to that effect. We'll see where that goes. But she is saying that, in essence, there is discrimination here based on disability.
And so if this complaint is upheld, will Terry Schiavo be allowed to be fed and then, of course, hopefully be released from the guardianship of her husband and be allowed to at least undergo some kind of therapy, however it will benefit her?
Well, let's say the first step would be, I don't know what the federal court will do, obviously. I mean, we've got a federal court situation here in California with the recall. Who knows what they're going to do? But what I hope will happen is that the federal court will at least issue an injunction saying you cannot proceed in this way until you've given this disabled person the right to receive therapy to see whether or not she can eat by mouth. That's the minimum that we owe her as a U.S. citizen who has a right to life and is a fully human person. Then if she receives that therapy, we'll be able to see which side of the case is right. That the side that says she can get better and would have, except she's been denied treatment for 10 years, she's just been lying in a bed for 10 years, or the side that says, look, she really is not capable of moving forward and improving. Now, if the former happens, the dehydration will be off because she will no longer require a feeding tube. If the latter happens, there are still arguments to try to prevent the dehydration, but at least that issue will be resolved. We will know whether or not she is capable of improvement. It seems to me common sense dictates that if you're going to give any benefit of doubt to life, you say, well, let's give the woman some medical treatment to see if she can get better. That's what she's been denied. And even if she said, which her family disputes, look, I don't want to be kept alive on tubes, I doubt she ever said that if I'm disabled, I don't want you to try to help me get better.
Wesley, finally, with only about a minute and a half here, is it still advisable for our listeners to continue to contact Governor Jeb Bush? And if so, what should the clear message be to the governor of Florida?
Absolutely. We need Jeb Bush, I think, is the key here. I think if Jeb Bush formally intervened, the whole case could be put into a completely different track. So the letters and communications to Jeb Bush should say, thank you for your letter, Governor Bush, but that was inadequate to the task at hand. We need you to formally intervene in this case and have the state of Florida name the guardian of Terri Schiavo in place of her husband. That's essential. Keep those cards and letters and phone calls coming.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. Here is the number for the office of Governor Jeb Bush in Florida. Area code 850-488-7146. That's area code 850-488-7146. Now, I'm going to give you the email address as well. It's a little long, so you will need to write this down. You probably won't be able to commit this one to memory. It is fl_governor@eog.state.fl.us. Now, I'm sure that if you type into a search engine, State of Florida, they'll probably take you to the State of Florida's website, which will have a link to the governor's email address as well. Here it is one more time, fl_governor@eog.state.fl.us. There is a link to that very email address at the end of Wesley Smith's column, found on his website, wesleyjsmith.com. WesleyJSmith.com. You'll find the email address for Jeb Bush there. When you write, you want to tell the governor that he needs to intervene through the state attorney general's office or through the health department of the state of Florida legally and see to it that the guardianship of Terri Schiavo is taken away from her husband who intends her to die. Tomorrow we'll talk about judicial activism with Amy White and religious discrimination on campus with Paul Copan. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.